Hello and welcome to Backflips and Nerds, the baseball podcast with a British twist. I am your host, as always, for our interview podcasts, John McGee, and I'm delighted to be joined by one of the best-known faces and voices in the world of baseball, a former special assistant to the GM of the Toronto Blue Jays, long-tenured member of ESPN's baseball staff, and now senior baseball writer at The Athletic, as well as the author of two brilliant books on the sport, Smart Baseball and The Inside Game, and indeed a polymath, a man who knows everything there is to know about music, film, board games, and whatever else he wants to talk about today. Welcome, Keith Law.
Thank you for having me.
A pleasure. And it's been fun and games getting here because you've just been vaccinated. We've just been having a bit of chit-chat about that, which is brilliant. Yes.
An hour before this conversation, I've got my second shot, so I am good to go. I feel like, obviously, it's two more weeks till I get the full benefit of the second shot, but I will actually be taking my first trip by airplane in 14 months to go see players, to go to Vanderbilt, because I got to see those two guys. If I see nobody else this spring, I feel like I would have to see those two pitchers down there for my draft prep, and I'm excited and definitely nervous because that involves interacting with large numbers of other people, and other people are probably the scariest thing in the world right now.
Yeah, they absolutely are. We were saying just before we started recording, we're gradually rolling out the vaccine in the UK, and at the same time, sort of gradually rolling back. We've had, I think, quite much more draconian rules about what you can and can't do in the UK than you have in certain parts of the US. And yeah, my partner and I are not quite comfortable enough to be in the same space as a lot of folk yet, but we're getting there.
Soon. I keep hoping soon. Like, I'll never really be comfortable, like truly comfortable, but at least I won't be thinking about it constantly. I've been out to games. I've been to a bunch of, obviously, you're outdoors, but mm-hmm. I've been to college games, high school games, which my first minor league game last night, and really don't think about it very much because I'm outside, not really sitting that close to anybody else.
Well, that's good. That's good. So we are, you know, the genesis of this conversation, we spoke to one another on Twitter, is to talk about your most recent book, which has just come out in paperback, at least in the States. It's definitely available in hardback here in the UK, which is The Inside Game. But there are a couple of things that I wanted to touch on before we get into talking about the book. And, you know, both of them, actually, well, two of the three have come up in the course of conversation already. But before we get to the baseball specifics, I just wanted to pick on something. So when we were having a conversation about setting this up, you sort of let slip your ties to the great principality of Wales by saying you wouldn't be stopped saying the phrase Cymru am Bath.
Cymru am Bith.
So what's your connection to Wales then, Keith? It's not something I knew about you.
Yeah, my wife, we got married during the pandemic, actually. We had a very minuscule wedding. She is truly Welsh. She was born in the States, but her parents are both born and raised in Wales, one from Cardiff, one from the Valleys. And so basically all of her family, other than her parents, are in Wales. I've only met them via Zoom. We do a monthly family Zoom, like a pub quiz. So I know them, but have not actually gotten to meet them. We keep saying we want to take a trip over for my daughter and I to go and meet the cousins. Our youngest is so young, she wasn't alive the last time my wife and family went over to Wales. So at some point we're going to get over there and meet the family and play tourists. And I'll get to practice all the Welsh I've been doing on Duolingo. What is it? Dwi hoffi'n gwylio orenai. And our half. I like watching the oranges in the summer. Very useful phrases that they teach you in that app.
Yeah, they really do. They seem to. I also use that app, and they seem to have a bit of an obsession with horses.
Yes, and a lot oranges. Of those. Yeah, and oranges are the big one. The other big one that I get repeatedly is do we them in a shy or tiger in a sweetva. I do not like the tiger in the office.
Well, there you go. I mean
fair, right? I probably wouldn't like one in the office right now.
I live in Manchester. I live pretty near to North Wales, about an hour mm-hmm. away. That there, oh, yeah. There are not a lot of oranges in Wales, but you know, just in case you weren't sure.
No, that's good to know. I had a whole citrus farm tour planned. As probably going to take that off, and I mean, I suppose we'll go find some sheep.
Yeah, you absolutely will do that, and some beautiful coastline. One of our yes. team, I mentioned to you, he's also in the Baseball Prospectus team. Did you know that there is a person living in Wales working for another of your alumni?
I did not know that.
There you go. So Darius Austin, who does all their depth charts, he does that from Conwy in North Wales, which not a lot of people know. So there you go.
Amazing. I will have to connect with him somewhere. North Wales is like, that's a whole different.
Yeah, it's a different. It's always like, a different.
Different dialect. Country. Yeah. Yes. I'll have another excuse to not understand him.
Exactly. A lot more of them speak Welsh there, so it'd probably be more useful than in the valleys. But anyway, we digress. And much as I'd like to talk about Wales for the next, 2 hours, we should probably talk about baseball, right?
Maybe.
So you mentioned there that you went to your and you had a piece out on The Athletic today that you went to your first minor league game yesterday. Yes.
Yep.
In Wilmington, you're in Delaware, and so how was that? How was the experience?
It was great. We lucked out too. It was absolutely stellar weather too, and because it was opening night, I got both teams' best starters, who's Grayson Rodriguez started for visiting Aberdeen, and Jackson Rutledge for Wilmington. So Wilmington is now a Washington Nationals affiliate after the whole shuffle. But they remain a high A team. Aberdeen has gone from short season up to high A, replacing Frederick, which lost its team entirely. But they stayed with the Orioles. And for pitching matchups, you're probably not going to do a whole lot better than that. Mm. I have each team's number two pitching prospect in my own rankings, two former first round picks. Both guys came out throwing gas too. Grayson Rodriguez, I wrote, hit 99 seven times in the first. That was my gun. And the stadium gun. In fact, friends of mine who were at the game came to me a little bit later and says, the stadium gun hot? I said, no, it's dead on. Actually, he really was sitting 99 in the first, which is just fun. Like, it's really fun. And it was sort of, I was by myself. There was somebody I know who's with the Orioles. She was row in front of me. So we chatted for a little bit. But also it was just, I'm at a professional baseball game. This is very weird. And also, I think I like this. I forgot how much I liked going to games and watching and taking notes and keeping chart. Like, all of that stuff is, I missed the minutiae. And I've said a few times to more people outside the industry, maybe for my own sake, like having a year away from that, it was a bit of a break. Obviously, it was stressful in other ways, but, a lot of the things that have become kind of rote are not so rote anymore. I've gotten out of the habit. I get back into them, and I'm reappreciating some of the finer points of doing my job and realizing, really missed going to games and evaluating players.
That's really awesome to hear. Like, really, really lovely. I mean, from our side of it, every game that we get to go to, because it's a hell of a long way, probably feels like that, but it's nice for you to sort of step it. Yeah, that is so great. I've heard that from others, but lovely to hear that from you as well. Mm-hmm. I wanted to touch on a couple of things about the minors, and you brought one up yourself about the rejigging and the thinning out of the minor league system. So you wrote quite extensively on this over the course of the last 2 years as the plans unspooled. Where do you think we are now, and do you think that this is a good thing, a bad thing, or does it remain to be seen? Because there are two schools of thought. We've had people on the podcast who've said it's purely something that's been driven by finance, by saving money for the franchises and their owners. But then there are others who've said fewer people on the books will lead to a more elite product. Whereabouts on the scale do you fall at this moment?
Yeah, I would say I think it's a big negative for the industry as a whole. I fully acknowledge, and did at the time, there were cities that probably shouldn't have had teams anymore. There were facilities that were out of date that, nobody wanted to play in those parks in Clinton, Iowa, and Hagerstown, Maryland, and Lancaster, California, which was less about the park, but more because of the wind there. You'd get these, it was like playing baseball on Mars. So you'd get these 23 to 12 games, and you just can't develop. Nobody wants to send players there. Nobody wants to try to develop pitching or hitting in those kinds of environments. Also, I thought, a lot of people were fond of the Appalachian League, which is now gone. It's not out of professional baseball. I was not a fan because I felt like taking kids from, obviously drafted kids would end up there, but taking kids from Latin America and having their first U.S. pro experience be in Appalachia, where nobody looks like them except their teammates. Like the one Appy League game I ever actually attended in person in Pulaski, there was not a person of color anywhere who wasn't on the field somewhere. And I, you know, it's not so much a problem with the games, but think about being that kid, you know, maybe 19 from the Dominican Republic, and suddenly you're dropped in a very white, very, you know, not super friendly to maybe immigrant populations sort of town, where there's nobody around who looks like you anywhere, and not food that you recognize or other products that you recognize, and they're not speaking a language, maybe they're not speaking your language, certainly. That's a huge assimilation ask. And it was less of an issue in, say, the Northwest League or the New York Penn League, where a lot of those teams were located near larger cities or just in somewhat more diverse areas. So all that said, some of that needed to change. But MLB, instead of sort of taking the yard trimmer, right, they came out with a chainsaw and just shot. They just wiped out 42 teams, got rid of short season leagues completely. So we have just Gulf Coast League and the Arizona Rookie League, both are rookie level or the bottom rung. There's now nothing between that and low A, full season ball. And I absolutely believe that there are many players who need that intermediate step, and it's just gone. And that is strictly to save money. And we are going to end up losing out on some players who choose not to come into pro ball, or who quit pro ball because they're not developing, or who stick with pro ball, but they don't develop as much as they should have because of that missing step. And to me, that is the number one problem. And it's, in general, fewer opportunities for players is probably a bad thing. And just, I feel like, you know, there are going to be teams that only run five affiliates. That's 150 players. And there were teams, like, my understanding is the Rockies, for example, wanted to mandate that no team could have more than 150 players in their system. And fortunately, I believe that was voted down by other owners, but still, like, do you, especially if you are the Rockies, you're going to depend on player development. You should want to have more players in your system somehow. And to me, this idea that, yes, they're saving money. Major League Baseball teams are saving money, just like some teams are saving money by cutting scouting. But that is extremely penny wise and pound foolish. You will be worse off in the long run by having fewer scouts identifying players and fewer places for those players your scouts do sign to play once they're in your system. And the only hope I have is that the teams that continue to invest as much as they can in those areas and have the maximum number of players, that they end up pulling ahead enough that the other teams say, oh, wait, maybe we made a mistake. Maybe we should move a little bit back towards the center as opposed to the old system where maybe we had a few too many teams, and this new system where I think pretty clearly we don't have enough.
Yeah, it will be interesting to see how it shakes out. You know, one thing that you said there, and it's something that's been rolling around my head around short season ball, is it also feels like there'll be more obvious and more public cuts more regularly, right? Because that sort of jump off point for new draftees, for new guys signing out of college to go to Lowell or to go to Staten Island, it's not there. So you know, those guys are going to go straight into low A ball, and people aren't necessarily going to move up. They're going to move out, potentially just out of the game altogether, potentially to, you know, one of the other MLB controlled circus leagues. Like the Atlantic League.
The Pioneer, you know, I have no problem with those. You know, the Pioneer League is doing this home run derby to settle X training games. You know what? They're an independent league. Go for it.
I kind of like that.
It's fine. It's very Bill Vec to do that stuff. I don't want that in affiliated leagues, but those leagues now have if you're an owner in the Pioneer League, think about it. There are minor league owners who had teams, like you mentioned, Lowell and Staten Island. Their owners just got nothing. They just basically get absolutely nothing. Or if you're in the Pioneer League, you had an affiliated franchise and that was worth something. And now it's an independent franchise. That's just worth less. Now suddenly you're paying the players and you are much more dependent on, you have to increase the revenue that you've got, which is almost all from fans coming into the ballparks. You have to find new ways to try to attract them. So all of these owners basically just got the shaft from Major League Baseball with little or no, mostly no compensation for what they've lost in terms of asset values. They do have to get kind of crazy to try to win more and get more fans into the ballpark. And hopefully you win and that does get more fans in the ballpark. But I worry that we're going to have a lot of players, like you said, who just look at, they get drafted, you either go directly to the rookie leagues or you go to low A. And imagine a college kid who gets drafted and he's not sent to low A. He's like, I got to play in the Gulf Coast League the rest of the summer, and I'm one of the oldest guys here. 17-year-old
Dominicans, right?
Who am I going to go out drinking with? Right, yeah. Exactly. You know, that I could see a lot of players looking at that and saying, F this, I'm out of here. Mm-hmm. And we're going to lose talent that way. We're absolutely going to lose talent to players who encounter that situation or just say, you know what, I'm just not interested. I'm just not going to sign. If I'm not drafted high enough or not going to get pushed enough, or the opportunities are that limited, that maybe I'll just go do something else. Cause it's not like after the first few rounds, the money isn't that great. And a lot of kids may say, I'm just going to go get a real job instead, even though it doesn't sound very fun. They may decide that that's the better career decision, financial decision, especially the ones who are married young, want to start families, all that stuff. They may be thinking more about money in the short term and say, you know what, I'm not going to play baseball. Maybe we lose a Paul Goldschmidt, who was an eighth round pick out of college. That sucks. That just sucks. And it is our own fault if we lose that kid.
Yeah. And I mean, it's the same in the new unaffiliated but partner leagues, the Atlantic League being the obvious one, where, you know, the reason that they didn't move the mound back a year and a half ago was because all of the pitchers said they were going to leave the league. Yeah. And now they're going to do it anyway. Not quite as much. And lo and behold, you know, at least one or two pitchers who I know, right. Yeah. I'm retiring. I don't want to do this because, you know, I'm here just in case somebody wants to sign me and put me in double A.
Right.
And it's not going to happen when I'm throwing from an extra foot.
Right. I mean, their options are now kind of limited. There aren't as many places for those guys to go. Do they go play overseas in like the Netherlands or something? They just don't have as many chances. Some of those guys are going to end up slipping through the cracks. And the independent leagues were a nice source of some extra talent. And some of those players did end up making the big leagues. Some lasted for a little while. It's another thing we miss out on if players choose not to go to those, you know, they're the indie leagues. You can call them partner affiliated leagues, whatever euphemism Major League Baseball wants to call them. It is we're not paying your player's salary, so you're on your own. That's those leagues. And like I said, a lot of those kids, I wouldn't blame kids like that who say, I'm done. I'm going to do something. I didn't make it on the first shot, basically. I'm going to go to do something else.
Yeah, indeed. On a similar note, I wanted to just touch very briefly on a really great piece that you wrote with Britt Giroli last week around the MLB Draft League, which was one of the replacements for some of the teams. Some of the teams, the SOP that they got was that they would be part of this big showcase event, which was, you know, part of the what Rob Manfred One Baseball plan. We also own. We want to do something that's a bit like. They have in the NFL with the combine. I couldn't bring the right word to mind, but you know, it's going to be a washout, isn't it? Based on your reporting so far.
So far, not so good, right? The roster. So for listeners who don't know, the draft league is a 6-team showcase league for draft eligible college players, draft eligible this year, that will take place in 6 of the cities and stadiums that were abandoned by minor league baseball and by Major League Baseball in the contraction. And they're all in my area. Trenton is one of them. It's an hour from my house. So I actually kind of have a vested interest in this league doing well. It would be great for me if real prospects, especially a lot of guys from around the country who were maybe not so easy to see in the spring, maybe a bunch of junior college kids or you know, kids at mid-major D1 schools or below who, you know, just don't get scouted as much because you can't line those guys up with a first rounder. So for someone like me, I don't generally go around seeing players below the first round because I don't have the budget to do so. It would have been great. And the initial rosters, the initial 6 rosters were not good. And that was my opinion, but that was also the opinion Britt Giroli at The Athletic. She and I worked on this piece together and she really took the lead on it. And we spoke to a lot of people from Major League team scouts and executives. And it was pretty universal that this was worse than what they expected. They thought there would be more talent. They were questioning whether it was worth committing scouting resources to go see that league. And if there are no scouts, there will not be players. That is going to be the number one problem for Kerrick Jackson, the guy, former scout who's running the draft league, and for Major League Baseball. It's a bit of a chicken and egg thing, right? The scouts aren't going to come if there aren't players. The players aren't going to come in the future if there aren't scouts. So they're going to have to figure out some way to try to get some better talent, even if it's just a handful of more significant names into the league this year, or nobody's going to show up. And then the league is going to have a very hard time, I think, recovering in year two. And there are good reasons for some players to go. They've got a bunch of big leaguers on coaching staffs around the league. These guys will be pitching in stadiums that have some of the, you know, StatCast style equipment that could potentially, would potentially give more data. So say that you played at a Division One, like a Division Two school or junior college, where your home state, you never pitched in an environment that had TrackMan. Now you could go pitch in this draft league and you'd be in an environment with TrackMan. And so teams that really need to have that data for their models would suddenly get it. That's a great reason for a prospect to go pitch in this draft league, even if he pitched the whole spring. There just aren't enough. They didn't get enough guys who are also good enough to sort of change the way that teams are going to try to approach this, to try to approach the draft league, to try to approach their scouting, to send more scouts to the league. And that's back to that chicken and egg problem. How do you get more players to come when, if the word gets around that, hey, there were only three scouts at Trenton Frederick's game last week, no one else is going to come. And trust me, I was all geared up to go to the draft league a bunch of times, but if there aren't players there, there's no reason for me to choose to go there instead of just going to see the best minor league game in the area.
Sure. And so just want to spend a couple of minutes talking about the draft. I'm conscious that, you know, this is absolutely your bread and butter. This is what you're working on every day. And we could probably talk for a couple of hours about the draft and not have any time to talk about the book. So I had a couple of questions, one about a specific player who you were really high on, and then another just about the draft in general. So sure. We'll start with the player who is Henry Davis, who appeared on the last episode of your podcast, the Keith Law podcast, as opposed to the one that you do with Derek Van Riper under the Athletic Baseball Show. So for people who don't know, he is a ranked somewhere in the top 10, but you have him higher than other publications. He is a really, you know, you were saying he's probably the best catcher other than Rutschman since Buster Posey. So why are you so high on Davis, and what's your view as to why you think of him higher than, say, you know, Baseball America or BP or others?
I saw him play two games at University of Virginia, and he swung and missed once in 10 plate appearances. He only made two outs, one of which was a fairly hard line drive off of a slider from a Virginia reliever who's got great stuff and just can't find the plate, Griff McGarry. It was a very impressive look. But Davis has also been doing this all year. He really never strikes out. He has power. He's got an exceptional eye. He's got a plus arm, and he catches fine. Somebody said to me, oh, I heard, you know, so, well, he may not stay behind the plate. I don't see any reason this guy doesn't stay behind the plate at all, unless somebody says your bat's too good and we're moving you to another position. He can catch, and he's already improved so much as a catcher just over the last 2 years that I feel like there's plenty of justification if you want to say he's going to continue to improve and end up an above average defender. I think he can get there. And the question that I've asked a lot of directors and cross checkers is, what am I missing here? This is a college catcher who's got performance and tools, and who never swings and misses when swinging and missing is so prevalent at all levels of the game right now, and who has great makeup and a good body, and he's reasonably athletic at a position that doesn't often have the best athletes necessarily. Yeah,
true.
What am I missing here? We like position players more than we like pitchers. We like college players more than we like college position players, more than we like high school players. And we want guys who play up the middle. He checks every single box. So why isn't he number one? Now, I don't know that he's going to be number one when I do another update, which I think is next week. I should probably start working on that at some point. But if you line him up, him versus Jack Leiter, well, I love Jack Leiter, and I'm hopefully going to see him on Saturday. But Leiter probably doesn't have a number one starter type of ceiling. Kumar Rocker, well, Rocker's had some ups and downs. His velocity has dropped a couple of times, and I don't think his fastball plays quite up. Certainly doesn't play up the same way that Leiter does. And Rocker's command is fine, good enough certainly for where he is, but he's far from a sure thing. Each one of the other candidates you could identify to go first overall has some bigger question mark or flaw than Davis does. And I just keep coming back to the Posey draft. Rutschman went first overall, and I believe I had him first on my board that year. And to me, that was completely logical that he'd be first. I keep going back to Buster Posey. When I had him ranked second, he went fifth in the draft. So relative to the industry, I did very well. But like the industry, I had Tim Beckham first. And I have never stopped excoriating myself for that because I had that argument myself. And I had that discussion with people in the industry. I remember having that discussion with one of Buster Posey's agents who said, why isn't he number one? And, you know, I think I talked a lot about Tim Beckham's athleticism and upside, but you know what? Buster Posey was kind of a pretty sure thing at that point. And is Henry Davis that kind of a sure thing? Maybe I'm not saying he wins an MVP like Posey did, but he's pretty good. And I think he's got a really exceptionally high floor, especially in a draft that maybe doesn't have a guy who's a Strasburg or Cole or Bryce Harper. There's nobody in this draft who's like, that guy's 1-1, no question. He's not there this year. So if we're just saying, well, who's the best of the rest? I feel like for me, Davis checks more of the boxes and has fewer flaws than anybody else.
It's really interesting. And it's also started to make me think about some of the themes of the book, which we'll come into in a moment. And maybe those sort of inherent biases that people in baseball have are there, right? Because you've got, you know, in most draft boards, there are two very toolsy high school shortstops, mm-hmm. both of whom have question marks, both of whom are very probably going to be very good players, but yes. you know, are the type of players who could flame out. And then you've got two very high profile, but risky profile pitchers.
Yep.
You know, you said Rocker's ceiling is arguably slightly higher, but also the likelihood that it might not pan out is higher also. Yep. It's a perfect encapsulation of those inherent biases that people are shifting away from in baseball. But this is a really good encapsulation of how they just can't quite kick the habit, can they?
Right. I mean, at least there's not a high school pitcher in the mix, right? So we've learned something, I think. Although I have a feeling Jackson Jobe, who's this year's best high school pitching prospect in the draft, he's probably going to go higher than he should based on the you know, what I identify as the base rate, the historical success rate, or I should say non-success rate of high school pitchers who are taken in the first round. They fail at a higher rate than every other class. We shouldn't be taking so many of them. The last 2 years, the first high school pitcher in the draft went 15 and I think 17. So it seemed like we might be learning something, but we'll see this year if that continues to be a trend or if that was a bit of a blip. But still, I think that you've got some of that base rate stuff coming into play. The certainty of a position player should count a little bit more, especially an up the middle position player should count more than a pitcher who maybe you think has a little more upside. I also wonder how much of this is just factoring in the fact that Rocker and Leiter both came into this year very famous, already identified as 1-1 candidates. Rocker had thrown that no-hitter in the College World Series 2 years ago. And Leiter, his dad pitched in the big leagues. Dad, his uncle, and his cousin, right? All pitched in the big leagues. So
then he threw a no-hitter.
Threw a no-hitter. Like, and then the week after, went seven no-hit innings. And Tim Corbin, to give him a ton of credit, took him out because he was trying not to overpitch the kid. So these guys check a lot of sort of maybe less relevant boxes. I'm not saying nobody cares about pedigree. I'm not saying that both these guys were first round talents out of high school who just didn't go there because they wouldn't sign. You consider that, right? But nothing to me should outweigh the player's current skill set or set of tools, however you want to define it. Those two terms are not quite interchangeable, and the player's current performance. And to me, Davis at least lines up with the other two in those areas, and clearly should be ahead of, as good as Jordan Lawler is supposed to be. And I know a scout who saw him this spring and said it's one of the two best high school position players he's seen. I just don't see a great argument for giving up the relative certainty, the relatively higher floor of the college position player over, in Lawler's case, a 19-year-old high school player. We know that there's slightly higher risk with a player who's older on draft day. I don't know that, you know, that's not what we'd call a kill. It's not a reason not to take the player, but it's a factor. It's one more thing that should go into the model, whether it's a model in your head or a model that you've actually designed that helps you decide who to take at various picks. That should absolutely be a factor. And to me, it's just each time you do like pairwise comparisons of Davis versus this guy, Davis versus this guy, Davis, he creeps up. He just keeps creeping on up and to the point where for me, he should be in that consideration. It should be him or Leiter. If it were me, if I were Ben Cherington making the pick for Pittsburgh, my decision set would really be those two guys. I'd explore other options because you have to, but I would primarily be focusing on those two kids.
It'd be interesting to see how things pan out. And, you know, we're 2 months out from the draft. You know, this changes
Thank
a lot,
God.
Right? You know, so we'll see how and whether things change. Just another question before we leave the draft. this, looking out at this sort of a helicopter view, maybe 18 months ago, a lot of people were saying this was the deepest and the best draft, you know, the most starry draft that we would see for a long, long time. You know, I have a sort of rooting interest. I'm a Boston fan, and obviously they tanked for pick number four last year. Yep. why else were they rolling out poor old Mike Kickham? Coming in, I'm paying more attention maybe than I might usually to the top end of the draft. But mm-hmm. it seems from you know, my untrained eye that the class has kind of shrunk a little bit. Like, you know, the quality at the top is not as strong as people. And is that because people knew the names of these players from when they were high school players, and that Lawler has been a prospect that people have been shining on for such a long time, from, you know, the age of 14 or 15, as people were with like Harper?
I have, yes, everything you said is true. Absolutely 100% accurate. I have some hypotheses on why that might be. One is that I think a lot of guys just underperformed this spring, guys who were supposed to be high picks, and whether it's rust from missing basically
Hill's injured, Fabian's been useless.
Fabian's been awful. I mean, so Jaden Hill, Tommy John, he was going to be a top five pick. Judd Fabian, I actually didn't have him ranked that highly because I knew he had some swing and miss concerns. Other sites had him in the top 10 going into the spring. I mean, at this point, Fabian's been worse than I even thought he was, right? And he still probably gets taken because he has tools. But that guy, the George Springer, very toolsy, you know, some questions about the bat, college position player, that guy still goes pretty stiff. And Fabian's not going to, because he's just not produced really at all and show no ability to make adjustments to multiple problems. Christian Franklin, very athletic college outfielder for Arkansas, very toolsy, but swings and misses a lot. And those guys we've seen, like the ceiling and the draft for those guys has been drifting down over time, where Cam Meisner 2 years ago, top 10 kind of tools, he goes in the comp round because he couldn't stop swinging and missing. So I have that hypothesis that rust is one of the factors. And maybe rust time off has increased guys getting injured, whether it's serious injuries like Hill or minor injuries like Richard Fitz was out of the rotation for Auburn for several weeks. And Eric Tarantola for Mississippi State, I don't know if he's been hurt, if he really just can't find the plate, but either way, it doesn't matter, right? This guy has top 10 stuff and isn't going to go in the first round. The other thing is, I wonder, California was very tough to scout this spring. High schools for a while weren't letting anybody in. They pushed their season back, so they were much later. California is typically where a lot of scouts spend the earliest part of their draft season. And from being unable to do it, came in, so California's not that great this year. Well, then you can't go out there at all. And so if you were a California high school kid who emerged this spring, or maybe who would have even emerged last summer, but the summer events, a lot of them didn't happen, you just never got that chance. And I wonder if there were certain parts of the country that, because of lockdowns, delayed seasons, or scouts just not going to certain places for their own travel reasons, maybe some of those kids just didn't get seen. And I don't know what happens to those kids. Do they go to junior college? Do they go to college? Does this mean 3 years from now, the college crop is epic because we missed a lot of high school kids this spring? That's not the worst outcome. There's nothing wrong with kids going to college, but it may partially explain why this year's draft, which I agree, I thought was going to be really good. And I thought we'd get some of the spill from kids from last year, right? That they would show up in this year's draft. They would go to junior college, or, you know, we do have a few of those college seniors, right? Or fourth year juniors, the Matt McCulskys and the Matthew Nelsons, who are going to do better this year. They were undrafted last year. It probably would have been drafted in a longer draft. But I hope that this means we're just going to see a better draft at some point in the future, because it just hasn't materialized, and it has made it a little weirder to cover. It's never bad. It's more fun when there's more elite players. This draft is fine. I've had plenty of guys to see myself. It's just weird. It's very hard to start talking about the tiers of the draft prospects when you realize that, hey, you got to have 30 guys in the first round. Well, it's probably only about, I don't know, 14 or 16 who look like regular first rounders. And now we're kind of getting creative to fill out the back of the first round, which is, you know, it's what happens when the draft class doesn't live up to expectations.
And do you think there's any potential for any weirdness within the round itself, because, you know, I think the Reds have got an absolutely enormous bonus pool. You've got the Red Sox picking at fourth, who completely confounded the entire industry picking at 18 last year by picking a guy everyone expected to go in the third round. You know, there's a few wild cards within this year's draft that could make it a bit strange in and of itself.
I completely agree. And I believe, and this is based on what people in the industry are telling me too, that once you get into the maybe late teens, maybe 20s, let's say once you get to the 20s, weird stuff's going to happen. Teams are going to take the second round on, hey, he was in the top 10 on our board. He was 74th on someone else's board type of players. And they're going to cut deals and go to try to see if, let's shave a bunch of money here at pick 21 or 22. So that when we come around again in the second round, or especially if the Reds have the extra pick, they can get really creative and try to find, try to get one of these. You know, there's still pretty good high school pitching out there. It's just teams realize we shouldn't take those guys too high, but there are plenty of those to take. If I were a team, you know, Pittsburgh or Texas or Detroit drafting high in the second round, or a team with an extra pick, I would be crushing the high school pitching this spring, trying to see it and figure out, look, they're not all going in the first round. Maybe we don't even need to know which guy gets to our second pick, but we need to be prepared for all of the possibilities. Maybe Andrew Painter, who maybe came into the year, I think folks thought he was probably going to be the best high school pitcher, but he started rough. He's been better lately. He's still pretty good. He might be a perfect example of a guy who, instead of going the first round, he's someone's second pick overpay. And nobody thought that was going to be the case on February 1st. So you better be prepared for all of the possibilities and be willing to get creative. And whether that means you, whether your first pick is 25 or your second pick is 40, you have to think about, hey, this draft might go even less according to plan than a typical draft does.
Yeah, so it's going to be a fun one to watch. So let's get on to talk a little bit about the book. So for those who haven't read it, and I'm assuming that's most people listening to this podcast, can you explain a bit of the idea behind what you wanted to posit in the book? Because it's looking at baseball. You know, some of the things that you talk about are things that we know. You know, don't draft high school pitchers, but the way that you know robot umps are better than human umps, and so on and so on. But you come at this from a quite sort of scientific perspective, and it's sort of based, if you like, in the works of the anthropologist and sociologist Daniel Kahneman, who maybe is not a person known to the common old garden baseball fan. So can you tell us a little bit about the book and a little bit about why Daniel Kahneman is so important in modern baseball?
So the idea for the book came from multiple executives, including Sigmundal from the Orioles, who mentioned to me the work of Daniel Kahneman and that they were trying to learn more about decision-making, the science of decision-making that comes from more behavioral economics or even cognitive psychology rather than sort of traditional economics, which that's my own academic background, at least as an undergrad. But what I learned was classical economics. Behavioral economics was still kind of too renegade for them to be teaching it at the, you know, small liberal arts college I went to. And I read Kahneman's book and then started reading a bunch of other books in the same genre. And one was that I just loved the stuff. I was like, this is fascinating. It's really cool. Hey, I make all these mistakes too. You know, there's no sort of easy way out. It is about changing the way you make decisions, changing your process to try to get around some of these cognitive biases or illusions. And then I realized that there wasn't really a book out there that explained these ideas for a lay audience. They all kind of assumed you had some economics background, maybe some psychology background, certainly more facility with logic and statistics than the average American would have, just because those subjects are not really taught in public schools in America. And I went to, I think, a pretty decent public high school, and we got a little statistics and zero logic. So I wanted to write a book that was accessible to everybody, that made no assumptions about what you know coming in, and that explained cognitive biases and decision-making in a way that was not technical and entertaining. And of course, the best way I could think of to do that was to talk about baseball and come up with lots of bad decisions. Baseball is such a decision-driven sport. It was very easy to find lots of bad decisions to break down in the through the lens of cognitive biases. Now, sometimes we don't always know that the cognitive bias applied, but to me, if an example demonstrated a cognitive bias, we could say, well, this was probably at play and it helped serve the greater purpose of, hey, I want to explain to you what status quo bias is. I went with it. It was easier to do that and say, this is what it looks like when someone makes this mistake, and then move on to the really important part, which is, what can you do to not make that mistake? How do you change your process? Or what could this decision maker have done differently to make a different decision? In the, whether it's in the heat of the moment or over the course of an off season, there are so many decisions in baseball that I probably could have kept going, except by the time I got to the end, I was like, you know what? I think I'm done. I think I need to do anything else but continue writing.
So the first chapter gives, I think, one of the best explanations as to why we need robot umpires as opposed to human umpires, because it's not just that, you know, they get these things wrong, it's that they overcorrect, and it's all about the psychology of making sure that they get things as right as possible on the day, that leads to certain biases in and of the people. And that's a really good example of the type of biases that you're trying to explain, isn't it?
Yes. So the chapter, I just opened it here to make sure I have it correct. The case for robot umpires, how anchoring bias influences strike zones and everything else. Yes. And anchoring bias works in lots of different ways. In the case that what I'm describing, anchoring bias means your brain essentially gets locked in on some number or some fact. It's usually a number. And that anything it hears after that is then skewed or biased by that number. And there's a famous example that I describe in the book where they ask a class to, they all have to give write down the last two digits of their social security number. And then they are asked to value something that would be between one cent and 100 cents, I believe it is. And their answers are skewed by whatever the question was afterwards. Their answers are skewed by the two digit number that they'd written down previously, which was nothing more than the two digits of random last two digits of their social security numbers. So we know this is real. And in a baseball context, what others have discovered, I am simply bringing this forward and explaining why this exists, is that umpires' calls on pitches at which the batter does not swing are skewed by anchoring bias. If the last called pitch was a strike and the next pitch is borderline, it's more likely to be called a ball. And the reverse is true. And it's particularly glaring in cases of where it's a 3-0 pitch, which is much more likely to be called a strike, even if it's not actually one, or an 0-2 pitch, where it's more likely to be called a ball if it's not actually one. And there is, there in that case too, you get another bias. You get two things at work. One is the status quo bias. And then second is the umpires just don't want to be the ones to make the decision, which is its own separate kind of bias. They're trying to essentially let the pitcher and the batter make the ultimate decision. And I say in the book too, I see it, you know, umpires are not dumb. This isn't smarts. This isn't a matter of intelligence. Are you human? Do you have a human brain? Most of us do. I have my doubts of a few people, but let's just stick with the majority. Then you have these biases. It doesn't matter who you are, how smart you are, where you went to school, what your education is. The biases are automatic. They're cognitive. They happen. They are almost pre-decision. So you have to recognize that, oh no, my decision here might be skewed by X bias, by anchoring bias. What do I need to do? Well, in this case, we have a potential solution in front of us, which is automated calling of balls and strikes. The technology that exists today probably won't really improve overall accuracy over what human umpires do, but it will be more accurate on the glaring calls, right? The pitch that's 3 inches off the plate is always going to get called a ball by robot umpires. Robot umpires are automated strike zone. Their errors will mostly be right on the margins of the strike zone. And I think most people can live with that. What they don't want is to see the pitch that splits the plate in two mistakenly called a ball. That's what gets people frustrated. That's what gets people thrown out of the game for arguing balls and strikes.
Yeah, I think you are quite forgiving to some of the umpires. Like there's a recognition within this inherent in what you're saying that actually they are really quite good at what they do. Like the activity that they are there for, they are elite. And even, you know, these maps that we're seeing this year about accuracy, you know, there's margin, you know, some are better than others, name no names, but one of them, because we don't want any of them to come after us, right? But they're good. But that doesn't get over the fact that, you know, just inherent in a human is that they want to sort of overcorrect for what they've done before.
Yes, absolutely. It is entirely human. These are human biases. This is a book that, you know, I don't really say this quite so specifically. This is a book about being human and how to overcome the flaws of being human, right? We all make mistakes. We make mistakes in our judgment. You know, one of the most popular columns I typically write every year is about players I got wrong, players where I evaluated them. Some are players I saw and my evaluation was just not accurate, or my prediction was not accurate. Some are players I didn't see and I just didn't get good enough information, or didn't get enough variation in the information I was getting. And that led me to rank or evaluate a player incorrectly. And, you know, I always joke, like, I'm never going to run out of players to talk about because I'm human, right? I will continue to make mistakes all the time. And no matter what you do, you're never going to get around all of the flaws in our decision-making process, but you can be better. I think that should be the goal, especially if you do, whether it's in your personal life or at work, if you find yourself in some role where you're making a lot of decisions, why wouldn't you just want to improve your decision-making process? Just be a little bit better. Being 10% better could make a lot of changes in your career, your life. And hopefully this book, even if it doesn't, maybe it gives some people the answers. Maybe it just makes you think more about it so that your eyes and your mind are more open to this idea that, oh yeah, what my brain tells me is definitely right is definitely not right.
So there's an absolutely amazing quote from Jonathan Swift that's at the start of the fourth chapter, which is about groupthink and about clutch, which we'll talk about in a second. I just wanted to like read this quote out because it's amazing. Like, falsehood flies and truth comes limping after it, so that when men come to be undeceived, it is too late. You could say this about like all of baseball. Like, that quote could be about the sport of baseball and its trajectory over, I think, the late 20th and early 21st century. You know, that could have been like the opening epigraph to Moneyball, right?
Yes. I don't remember when I found that quote too. It was while researching the book, because although I'm sort of a kind of a closet Anglophile, I'm very closeted in that. Jonathan Swift was never one of my favorites, but when I came across that quote while probably looking for something else, I was like, well, this is perfect. And it seemed very perfect for our time too, where you sort of live in an era of fake news and flying misinformation. I mean, it's continuing to go now, where we've got an entire news network in the United States dedicated to spreading outright falsehoods about the COVID-19 pandemic and the vaccines that can help prevent it. So it felt very timely to have that, and probably would never, you know, that quote from Swift is what, 200 years old or probably close to, it's probably never going away. Its utility is never actually going to decline. But, you know, that
unlike
chapter,
Albert Pujols, right?
That's right.
You bless him, gets a bit of a kicking in this book.
Yes, unfortunately. It is sort of funny. I pick on some pretty great players. Pujols and Miguel Cabrera both get it at some point in this book, and both
guys, and David Ortiz as well.
Yeah, David Ortiz. Yeah, people get very upset when you point out David Ortiz is not clutch. He's just good, right? Those are those are not quite the same thing. But that, I actually really love the title of that book because it encapsulates one of these problems, one of these cognitive issues in such a common phrase. It is, but this is how we've always done it. It is like the Spinal Tap, but this one goes to 11. You just, now you've stopped answering me, right? We're no longer having a discussion. Well, why do we do it that way? Well, but this is how we've always done it. And then you suddenly realize it's like you're arguing with a toddler at that point. Like, we're no longer having a rational discussion here. You're just falling back on almost an emotional argument of, you know, you're sort of clutching the teddy bear of no. I'm much more comfortable doing it this way. I don't know how to do this any other way. And the problem is that leads to lots of really bad decisions that can have pretty significant impacts on the outcomes of games in baseball. And it's why I talk about things, that is the baseball myths chapter. So I talk about clutch hitters and I talk about lineup protection, which, my God, I still hear about all the time. People just can't undeceive themselves, even though there's no evidence lineup protection actually exists. And people have been looking at this question for 40 years and we still can't find evidence it exists, and they still believe it does. I mean, I should be clear saying it doesn't exist at the major league level. Could that exist in high school or college? Sure. No one's looked at that as far as I know, and I'm not concerned about it. I'm talking about in the big leagues. And this is one of those situations, same with clutch hitters, where if you just stop and look at the data, you'll know it's not true one time. And yet sometimes people look at the data and say, well, I don't like the data, I'm just going to keep believing what I always believed. And sometimes people just aren't willing to question the assumption in the first place. And one of the big points of the chapter is, hey, just because we've always done it that way doesn't mean it's right. So question everything. Be willing to open yourself up and say, hey, I've been doing it this way for 5 or 10 or 15 years, but I might be wrong. And once you do that, once you open yourself up to question yourself or to let people around you question you, you are much more likely to have a robust decision-making process at the end of that kind of inquiry. Even if you don't change anything, you may ultimately realize, no, the way we always did it was actually pretty good, but now we know it's pretty good. We've established through evidence that we had a good process, or you'll make a change based on what the evidence tells you. So as opposed to letting emotion or gut or nostalgia drive the decision-making, here it's no, let the evidence tell you what to do, and then and stay open and let the evidence, if the evidence changes, you change what you do as a consequence.
Yeah. So I wanted to ask you about a figure who I think is kind of the Banquo's ghost of this entire book. You know who I'm going to talk about insofar as he does appear every now and again, but also embodies in human form all of the themes of this book and is back. It's Tony La Russa.
Yes.
I have been, as we all were, incredibly vexed to see him back in the dugout, but also in some respects, kind of very irritated, but also sort of heartened by the fact that people can see what a negative impact he is already having on that franchise. I mean, I don't know where you stand on this. And how tempted were you to mention him in every single chapter?
Oh, it would have been so easy, right? And it's funny, it is a peculiar topic because Tony La Russa was not a bad manager in his prime, but he was a flawed manager who did some things very, very well and other things obviously not very well, and proved himself really to be kind of, especially towards the end of his previous tenure. And then as he moved on into the front office with the Diamondbacks, increasingly hostile to the facts. Like, I don't think he was always like this, but he became increasingly set in his ways and increasingly kind of grouchy about various things. When Tim Lincecum won the Cy Young Award in 2009, the first time I ever voted on a Cy Young Award, La Russa was like quite irate over it. And even though there was pretty good case on the evidence for Lincecum winning, like that was actually not that controversial once you looked at pretty basic data on the question. And that was kind of an early sign. It's like, oh, this guy might be not the person we thought he was 10 or 15 years ago. Now he takes a 10-year layoff from managing, comes back. He's one of the oldest managers in baseball history, and he's worse than ever.
With that squad as well, right?
With
the most talented, outgoing, fun-loving squad that you've got, and he's out there saying, you mean Mercedes, you need a day off, Jake Lamb needs reps, right?
Right. And now we've seen both our own Ken Rosenthal at The Athletic and Jeff Passan at ESPN, I believe, have both written stories in the last few days about what a bad job Tony La Russa is doing. And, you know, that's the kind of column I might write. Right. But those guys are not, you know, they're writing what they're hearing. They're not out there sort of constant analysis and breakdown and, you know, who's doing a bad job. Like, that's kind of more of the thing I might find myself doing. And the fact that they're doing it, that means they're hearing it from a lot of people. And that everyone's noticing that, you know, every 29 teams maybe are using one particular playbook and La Russa has it upside down. It's just not working. It's not working from a personality perspective. It's also not working from an on-field management perspective, failing to pinch hit an important situation, overusing Lucas Giolito and Matt Foster in two games in a fairly short period of time. It's like, it's ugly.
I mean,
it's
leaving Giolito out for over 40 pitches. It was clear that the Red Sox knew what was coming.
And Giolito said after the game, you know, I didn't really think I had a lot left in the tank. Well, he knew that. I'm sure the catcher noticed it, and La Russa never did. You know, it's funny. You know, you don't want to make too many jokes about a guy his age maybe being asleep at the wheel, but it certainly seems that way. Many of the decisions he's made have almost expressed a sort of implied ignorance of the game state, that he just didn't quite know where we were in the game at that particular moment, how much Giolito had pitched or what the last few pitches he'd thrown had looked like, or who was actually coming up in that situation where I believe he let Billy Hamilton hit for himself, right? Because he was looking for a single. Billy Hamilton is only at the plate if you're looking for an out, right? This is just not a thing.
Billy Hamilton's only on the field if you're looking for defensive replacements.
Right, surely, right. Or he's starting on second base. That's fine. So, yeah, it really just feels like LaRusso's just not with us. And, you know, I want to be somewhat sensitive because of his age, but at the same time, like, they made this choice. And frankly, the owner made this choice. I don't believe anybody in baseball operations wanted LaRusso to be the manager. The owner picked his friend. And that is the owner's right because he owns the franchise. But boy, should we criticize the hell out of it. And because this was a bad decision on baseball terms, and that's a very bad process. Just picking the guy because you know him. I mean, that is sort of like all the situations where you see where the interim guy just gets the job because he's already there. Well, wait a minute. You didn't pick him to be the interim guy through a full process where you researched all your candidates and went through an extensive vetting process. Like, you didn't do any of that. You just picked the guy who was there because he was handy. Sometimes it works out. More often than not, it doesn't.
Yeah, I mean, it's exactly the same in soccer. You know, that's the story. Oh, well, you know, we brought this caretaker in and he won five games and now he's our full-time right. manager. And, you know, within a year, he is invariably not.
Right. Yeah, it becomes very clear. Right? Just those as process, bad. the lack of process eventually reveals itself. But by that point, you've already done some damage.
Sure. And so a couple of other particular scenarios around baseball that I think are really interesting when you start to look at them through some of the lenses in here. I want to come to those in a second, but you talk quite a lot about sort of cutting your losses in one chapter towards the end of the book around sunk cost. You know, there's no such thing as a sunk cost because, you know, it's still on the books, but also that doesn't mean that you need to keep, God bless him, Albert Pujols or right. Chris Davis on the roster, because it just makes you worse. You know, you're essentially throwing good money after bad. I wanted to ask you about, because he's fascinating to us as a podcast, I think there's one example where, which is Rusney Castillo. He is like the exception to this rule where the team both paid him and he was not, and got rid of him. He was like the sort of the edge case of this entire thing. But also, like, I find him fascinating because I just don't know what happened, and I don't know how you maybe do know, because you talk to people and you. Why did he never get back? Was it because of this? Because Ben Sherrington and Dave Dombrowski was smart enough to not do this to their club.
And there would have been a huge financial hit, I believe, if they've gotten him back, right? I believe that was ultimately the reason he couldn't be called back up, which is a shame, but it's those are the rules.
$72 million they right? saved by waiving him, yeah.
By waiving, right? And so it was, it's a shame because he probably could have had a small career, but once it became clear he was never going to be as good as he'd originally been claimed to be, I will say I saw him in the fall league right after he signed. And I remember thinking I was looking at the wrong guy because he was very muscular, very tight, but small. Mm. And I was like, God, I thought this guy was supposed to be taller, bigger, strong. And I never thought he was a disaster. Okay. Mm. I didn't write a whole lot about him after seeing him, but I remember thinking this guy could play in the big leagues. I just didn't think he was a star, right? They paid him like he was going to be a star. And we kind of will never know. Like, I don't think it's entirely fair to say, oh, he was a total bust, because if he'd been any other player, he would have gotten multiple chances, right? He would have been up and down, and maybe he would have been tried in different roles. Maybe he gets traded and somewhere there ends up, you know, getting a different role, becomes a platoon guy. He just got none of that. That second shot just simply never materialized for him.
Yeah, and in large, and actually they changed the rules because of it. Like, they changed the rules so that money would have stayed. And like, even if that rule change had come earlier, he probably would have been picked up because people would have known that they had to take the money on. He is just, I think, one of the most fascinating what ifs in baseball. And even though the chapter is not about him, I was just like, yeah, but there is an example of a team that got away with this. we are absolutely obsessed with the guy on our podcast just because of what happened to him.
Sure.
Because he became like a bit of a cult figure in Pawtucket. I wanted to talk about a couple of things. So it's interesting that you picked up on Lucas Giolito, who's another favorite of ours on the podcast, not just because he's a great player, but because he just seems like an incredibly great human being as well. Mm-hmm. And I I'm really fascinated. So I listened to the podcast that you did with Lucas. I've mm-hmm. seen the really great conversation he did with Pitching Ninja and some of the stuff he's been doing with Chris Rose. Mm-hmm. I think what Lucas is doing, and to a lesser extent, a pitcher we were rather less fond of in Trevor Bauer is doing. Is this kind of the next edge of this type of thinking? Thinking about mechanics, about how you do what you do on a mound. And it's not just about grips anymore, you know. There's been trading of grips and teaching of grips for years and years. You know, that's been the sort of hocus pocus of pitching in baseball.
Right. But
thinking outside of the orthodoxy of how you exert yourself to throw a ball as fast as possible and as safely as possible, is that perhaps the edge of where we are in terms of orthodox thinking and the next horizon for this type of, you know, step forward in terms of advancing the game?
I mean, I do think that because of Driveline more than any other single entity, but now other people have sort of sprung up as, you know, they're trying to build their own little Drivelines, follow similar philosophies, try to find their own philosophies. There are no critics of Driveline, but what Driveline has really done, and what they deserve the most credit for, is that they have shaken up the orthodoxy, right? They have made people open their minds to other ways of thinking and other ways of doing things. I don't know enough to tell you what Driveline does right and not right. And are they good? Are they bad? I mean, I think they're net good for baseball. That's not what I'm saying. Like, but in terms of their individual philosophies, like a lot of their stuff, they argue we're just evidence-based, right? We measure everything and then we use that to make changes. Sounds like a good process to me. I'm very much on board with that. I don't know that that's going to work for every player. I don't think they would claim it works for every player, but it has helped many players. They have helped a lot of players throw harder. They have helped a lot of players come back from injury and try to remake themselves. And now you see teams either just outright hiring people from Driveline, which is great for them, or just saying, well, we want to do some of those things ourselves. And to me, I'm very much in favor of more experimentation and more open-mindedness. There are 30 teams. You cannot all follow the same approach. If you try to do that, then probably what's going to happen is the Yankees and the Dodgers are going to win a whole lot because they have the most money. And it is the teams that constantly innovate, like Tampa Bay, for example, continuing to win and to succeed on one of the smallest payrolls in baseball and one of the smallest budgets in baseball. And one of the few teams that might actually be justified in running such a small budget because their stadium and their situation there is kind of bad. So yet they continue to win. Why? Because they innovate. And they believe in people. I will say also in Tampa Bay's people management is at the top of the scale as well, but they are very innovative and they're not necessarily just doing Driveline stuff, but I put them both in the same intellectual bucket where they're both saying there are better ways to do this. There are better ways to think about this, whether it's from player development to, you know, deploying players on the field. Tampa Bay was kind of the first team to do the opener, and whether you like it or not, whether you find it aesthetically pleasing, doesn't matter. It has helped them win games. And to me, that kind of innovation should be applauded even when it doesn't work.
Sure. Do you think that the Driveline revolution has helped sort of cross the frontier with the players? Because they're sort of the last shibboleth here. You know, they're the ones who are like, you know, but I've always done it like this. I've always thrown the ball like this since I was a kid. And seeing the Giolitos, the Bowers, the Marcus Stromans of this world have success doing something different. Even going back to like Rich Hill, just throwing curveballs. Has all of this practice helped the players become a bit more open-minded and become a bit more thoughtful about their role in improving the process and improving their own opportunities as well, I guess?
Yeah, I think it has. Has it helped open more minds? Yeah, I think so. The one thing that generally ties all players together, regardless of where they're from, what their beliefs are, their personalities, is they all want to be better. They pretty much all want to get better. And especially when they fail or struggle, they're very open to anyone who suggests something. I mean, that's why you have players do things like, what is that, cupping or fighting or all this other pseudoscience that doesn't actually do anything at all except transfer money from players to the charlatans who are pushing this stuff. But guess what? They do it because they're like, I want to be better. I'll try. And I'm struggling. I might get released. I'll try anything. So players become open-minded when they're pushed enough. What I feel like is a little bit different now is that players are open-minded even when they're already going good. And I do think Bauer is a good example of that, where Bauer has had some success and yet is in a process of continuous improvement. I don't know what he calls it himself, especially because he has me blocked on Twitter. But I feel like that's what he is, right? He's like one of those companies that says we're just constantly improving. It's we never stop. We're constantly innovating. And you take on some risk. You know, if Bauer at some point ended up suffering a catastrophic arm injury, I think a lot of people would say, well, it's, you know, you kept messing around. Of course, that was going to happen. Where I would say, I think he probably knows that's the risk, but he's trying to constantly be better. He recognizes that there's always some room for improvement. And probably as he gets older too, he'll lose some arm strength, he'll lose a little velocity, and he'll have to continue innovating. But once innovating is already sort of part of your ethos, as it is in Bauer's case, and this, he's not the only one, but you mentioned his name, so he's front of mind. Once that is part of the way you think about your craft, it's probably always going to be that way. Mm. And that's a good thing. That is one thing I would like to see more players kind of embrace is, yeah, I'm good now, but what do I do to stay this way? And what do I do to ensure that I stay good even when this one core skill, my fastball velocity or bat speed, does start to slip when I get older? And how do I compensate to keep myself effective for as long as possible? If you think about that stuff when you're going good, it's already there when you're going bad and you have the added stress or the added pressure of trying to continue to succeed or trying to reestablish your success when you also know that continued failure might maybe end up with you losing your job.
Yeah, absolutely. It's interesting. You talked a bit about innovation and you know, only the Tampa Bay Rays could overlook Oliver Drake's pitching action, but I don't want to dwell on that. You said that Sig Mandel was the man who brought Daniel Kahneman to your attention. And obviously, mm-hmm. you know, he's with the Orioles now with working with Michael Elias, but he started his career in professional baseball working with the Astros and under Jeff Luhnow. I kind of wanted to get your take on this. Is there a possibility that what transpired with the Astros on the field and in the dugout and from the players perhaps has the potential to overshadow just how revolutionary and important some of the thinking that went on behind the scenes within that organization was?
Not for people who know, right? People who know better, people in the industry, they recognize it. I mean, there are three things to take away from the Astros. One is the innovation. And they were ahead of their time on so many ways, a lot of ways that haven't really necessarily come to light yet. Then there's the on-field stuff you're talking about. The sign stealing scandal.
Yeah.
But also, to me, like the sign stealing scandal stuff, yeah, it's not okay, right? That actually doesn't bother me as much as what became the sort of what I think is the lasting legacy of Jeff Luhnow's regime there, which was we don't need scouts anymore. Mm. We don't really need people. I mean, that's really what his belief was. We can run this with far fewer people than anybody else did. Mm. And one, I don't think that's true. Two, I find that view kind of misanthropic.
Yeah.
And three, you know, the proof is in the pudding. That Houston system got a whole lot worse when they weren't picking first overall. They got rid of a bunch of their scouts. They started picking at the end of the round, and all of a sudden the drafts were worse. And their pipeline of US born or US, you know, draft eligible players has dropped off substantially. Hmm. And that is no accident at all. To me, and the problem is other teams have mimicked that. Hmm. And Houston still hasn't staffed back up, even though they've changed GMs. Hmm. Milwaukee has cut a lot of their staff because they came out of the Houston model.
Yeah.
Baltimore has cut quite a bit of their scouting staff. And supposedly Cleveland is going to cut a bit of their scouting staff. I don't think that's the answer. First of all, I don't think that's that large of an expense. You're not saving actually that much money relative to what you might gain if your scouts find somebody in the eighth round and turn them into a quality bid leader. But also there is something that is, I find really distasteful, what that says about people, that you don't think people are actually worth having, that you don't think they're relevant to the success of your franchise. I can't speak to, you know, who those people are, how they were raised or what they believe about their fellow man, but I am not one of them. I think you build people, you build a successful culture, and then you keep the best people you can. And you know what? Two franchises are really great at that. Tampa Bay and the Dodgers. Mm-hmm. Oh, what do you know? They both made it into the World Series last year. Maybe not totally a coincidence.
Absolutely true. Yeah, I mean that's right. You know, it that wasn't a question designed to sort of give a mulligan to the front office there. You
Of
know,
course.
I think it's clear if you read Ben Reiter's book Astro Ball, if you listen to
Oh,
his
yeah.
absolutely brilliant podcast series that he does following up on it. Jeff Luna's not a nice human being.
He
You know,
I don't like
what
how
he
he treats
brought to the
people. Yeah.
sport is not, and the culture which you know, perpetuated within that entire front office, Brandon Taubman, et cetera,
Yeah.
was terrible.
Yeah.
I had a couple of last questions, and I
Of
feel
course.
like, you know, we're sort of wending our way to this because, you know, you've raised it in comments about Trevor Bauer, and indeed in your answer to that question, you on your own website, you know, you have a whole tag like about not sticking to baseball. You know, you've never stayed in your lane. It's been part of, you know, the USP, and it's caused rifts with three of your colleagues, most notably with Curt Schilling. I mean, I find the idea that baseball and politics, or any sport, you know, we've seen it in the UK in the last few weeks with this notion of a European Super League. The notion that politics and sports are not inextricably linked is asinine. And you know, is that kind of what it is for you, that you'll want to sort of show that the hypocrisy that people who want to try and draw these things apart are trying to hide away from the real truths that are at the heart of what the impact the sport has on society?
It was two things for me. More personally, was just this idea of, no, you're just a baseball writer. You're not allowed to talk about anything else. And to which I have a fairly profane reaction when I see that. I am a person of diverse interests, and I had a career before baseball, and have quite a bit of education that's not terribly related to baseball, and have, I think, a lot to say, and I try to limit it to subjects where I think I have something to say. I actually don't weigh in on many matters of economics anymore, because I think that field has gone so far beyond what I learned in school that I just don't feel like I'm that well equipped to comment on it. But there are plenty of things where I do feel like I'm equipped to comment, and don't see any reason. Look, if you don't want to hear what I have to say, don't follow me. Don't read it. No one is forcing this. This is not Clockwork Orange. And second is, and then the second is essentially what you said. It's this great lie that sports is some sort of refuge, that sports is immune to matters of politics, economics, or social justice. So much of what happens in sports is a function of politics, not the least of which is that most teams play in government subsidized facilities. The economic issues of privately funded companies, that the huge wealth transfers that are essentially taking place from taxpayers and often from players who come from disadvantaged backgrounds, at least in baseball, while they're still young, just go right to the owner's pockets. Social justice can be as simple as you get the huge disparities in opportunities for youth players in the US and elsewhere to play baseball, which is a fairly expensive sport, even at the youth level, to questions of, hey, where Atlanta moved its stadium out of a majority black area to a majority white area. Well, that's not a coincidence, obviously. Or, what the damage that Los Angeles wrought on its majority minority communities when building facilities and infrastructure for the 1984 Olympics, and the increased police presence in its minority communities to, air quotes, clean up the city slash get the minority people out of sight as much as possible leading up to those Olympics. You can't separate the two. You absolutely cannot separate the two. When you see policemen armed to the teeth inside and outside a sports facility, guess what? They're already linked. That's politics. That's social justice. The police role in our, this is obviously a major topic in American society right now, but the way that we police, especially our minority communities, and the way that we talk about our minority communities, especially when they dare to protest, you can't separate that from sports. Colin Kaepernick just made it one step more explicit, but it was always there. It's just that the people who consume the sports, the people who own and run the sports leagues, are majority white, and they had the privilege of ignoring all this stuff. It's still there. And I am, I'm no hero. I'm just pointing it out. But there are people who could probably do something more about this. to mix sports. And I will say the NBA seems to be taking a leadership role in this, where they're trying to make the league more of a vehicle for social change. It'd be really nice to see baseball catch on.
And in that vein, do you feel like the decision to move the All-Star game away from Atlanta this summer was anything more than a gesture? Or do you feel like that there is an opportunity for probably the players, I would say, most likely to drive? It's certainly the way it is in the NBA. It's the high profile players like LeBron James who are driving the change. Do you think that this might happen? Because, you know, whenever I have conversations with people like you, and just generally with baseball fans, particularly in the States, it's an even bigger problem. You know, that lack of diversity is hugely problematic. The lack of young Black players who feel like they want to play baseball because they don't see themselves on the field. The lack of Black players who want to play the game but can't access it because it's so expensive. The lack of, you know, there's so many gates, and you know this better than anyone, being involved in, you know, the drafting process and following that. Is that something that you feel like the sport's committed to addressing? Or are we kind of beyond the point of no return with that?
I think they did the right thing moving the game. And I know there's some moving the game from Atlanta to Denver. And I'm personally glad, because I didn't want to go down to Atlanta and spend a bunch of mostly my company's money, but a little of my own money in a state that has rather clearly, in my opinion, declared war on democracy. That said, I think it was a bit of a PR thing. It was more that got people's attention, and that's good. It continued the dialogue about what's gone wrong in these Southern American states that are trying to suppress the vote. That's good. It is not part of an ongoing program for change, and that's not good. That at that point, it becomes a gesture. My understanding that it was pushed on MLB by corporate sponsors. It was not a moral decision by MLB. It was not pushed by the players. Players never even got involved in the decision, although my understanding is the union was ultimately in favor of the choice. That this was from the corporate sponsors. And so, you know, I think MLB needed to be, hey, that's a great step, but follow it up with, okay, what are you doing now to actually try to enact change? And I think that the problem is in the sport's DNA, and that sort of genetic problem also crops up in the sport's ongoing difficulty in promoting its non-white stars. And you brought up look, representation matters. When young Black kids are thinking about, you know, have a chance to play more than one different sport, and they look on TV, and if they look at baseball and they see, if they're not watching Marcus Stroman pitch, they don't happen to see Byron Buxton, who's like a human highlight machine, or if baseball isn't promoting those guys enough, well, then they may say, even subconsciously say, I want to play this sport, or I feel like I belong in the sport where there are more people who look like me. We know that representation matters. We know that stereotype threat is real. There's plenty of research showing this stuff. Baseball is still, it still has a hard time coming to terms with the fact that this is a sport that requires a multicultural, very diverse talent pool, and yet cannot quite embrace its non-white players. Whether it's players from outside the United States who just bring a different kind of energy or different style of play, or simply Black players who, for whatever reason, baseball just still, I think, when it comes to marketing the sport, treats them as second-class citizens.
And it's ridiculous. You know, it's easy for me to say this as, you know, a middle-class, middle-aged white man who lives 5,000 miles away. But, you know, forgive me a little indulgence. The most exciting, the most exhilarating guys in this sport right now, they are Byron Buxton. They are Fernando Tatis. They are Juan Soto. They are Tim Anderson. They are Mookie Betts. They are Xander Bogaerts, with the honorable exception of old Mr. Potato Head over in Los Angeles himself, yes. Mr. Michael Trout. They are all Black and minority ethnic. You know, it's actually like amazing that they get this so wrong. I'll never get over how they do it.
It is astonishing to me. And it's not like there are not Black and Latino, Latinx executives throughout baseball, but I think ultimately enough of the decision makers at the very top of the pyramid are either themselves white, and thus you struggle with seeing past their own privilege here, or are just entrenched in, going back to something in the book, this is the way we've always done it. Right? Baseball, you know, this idea of simply promoting baseball as sort of more of a genteel sport is about 50 years out of date. And that's never made explicit, but it's certainly clear when you think of the players that they have often chosen to promote and how hard it's been for them to get around to accepting that Fernando Tatis Jr. is one of the most exciting players in baseball. Ronald Acuna Jr., same thing. These guys should be they're the ones you should be pushing out there as much as possible. As good as Mike Trout is, I actually kind of agree. He's not the most marketable player, and it's no knock on him, but he's incredibly talented, but he is not quite as exciting, maybe necessarily, as some of these other players. You know, right. He's super nice. I've talked to him. Nice. He's really nice. I have talked to him. He's really nice and he's thoughtful, but he's also very, he's just kind of a quiet guy. That's just kind of who he is. And he should be exactly who he is. I don't ever want Mike Trout to change to satisfy anybody else. But that's fine. Pick someone else. We have, 800 or so players in a typical year, maybe more at this point, given how much we cycle through pitchers. My God, find somebody else and pick, hey, if Javi Baez is having a good year, I think he is absolutely one of my favorite players in the game to watch. Because when he is going good, he plays with so much style, more style than anybody else I can think of in the last 20 or 30 years. We need those highlights out there. And I will say Major League Baseball is doing a better job on the little stuff, like on social media. They just embrace all players. I think they do a better job with that. It's more of the macro stuff that I would like to see baseball do a better job with. And we're just not there yet. And it could be the leadership there. It could be the fact that the media that covers baseball is still, myself included, obviously, overwhelmingly white and male. And maybe that's maybe that drives the coverage. Maybe it's a sort of a negative symbiotic relationship here where we're encouraging each other in this idea of essentially promoting a sport that hasn't really existed for about 50 years now.
Yeah, exactly. And for again, climbing back onto my soapbox, forgive me yet again, for me, this is kind of inherent in this obsession with a sort of recreating a backwards facing version of baseball. More balls in play, more stolen bases,
yes,
more BABIP. That's the big red machine, and they were the most innovative and forward-looking team of the 1970s. The version of the big red machine for the 21st century is the Los Angeles Dodgers, and they throw 100 mile an hour strikes above the zone and they hit dingers. That's what baseball is now. And it kind of feels like there's this existential crisis that doesn't need to be there. And all of these things are part of the same sort of mad psyche, which is at the core of your book, which is this sport doesn't know how to get over itself and think a little bit outside the box.
Yeah, I would agree with that. The sport doesn't know how to get over itself is a very good way to put it. And yeah, they need to do all those things you just mentioned. They need to get more balls hit into play. They need to raise the bottom of the strike zone. Maybe they need to just shrink the strike zone top and bottom. You can start the runner on second base in extra innings. It's not bringing anyone back to the ballpark. Probably we can't even keep the people in the ballpark long enough for that. So we need to, and I actually personally, this is a whole separate conversation. I hate moving the mound back because I think you're just going to get a bunch of pitchers hurt. But one thing you can do pretty easily is shrink the strike zone and get more balls hit into play. Shrink the strike zone, deaden the baseball a little bit. It'll start to look a lot like baseball used to look. And then you can continue changing from there. Those are easier changes to implement. And then you will see almost right away how far you got in the direction in which you were trying to go.
Yeah. It feels like, we talked way over time. That's more than enough of your time, Keith. Thank you so, so much for being so generous with your time. It's been a real pleasure to talk to you. I've said already that people can get copies of the book. It's available on all online book services in the UK. Unfortunately, I don't think the mom and pop shops where we'd all rather buy it are going to carry it, but they might be able to get it if you ask them nicely. Keith, if people want to continue following you and following the rest of your work, where's the best place to find that?
So you can follow me. If you subscribe to The Athletic, you can see all my stuff there. I also, I'm on Twitter at Keith Law. And I also maintain a public Facebook page. It's Keith Law Writer there. And I have a personal blog, which you did mention, which is at meadowparty.com/blog, where I mostly write about other stuff beyond baseball. I don't do any real baseball content there other than asking some reader questions, but that's where I do board game stuff and book reviews, movie reviews, anything that just basically isn't baseball, that doesn't have a home somewhere else. I try to post there as often as I can. And then it often ends up the thing where I'm like, I could write something there today, or I could take a nap. And then I take a nap.
And if people want to get some really interesting music recommendations outside the rest of our podcast, taking the mick out of me for liking bands with silly names, Keith is the place to go. I see that we are certainly have in common a real interest in the bands Waxahachie and yes. King Gizzard and the Lizard Wizard, which is one that's come up in this podcast before, and I got ridiculed for it. So I'm glad to have a fellow fan.
How can you not like? They're so prolific. If you didn't like the last King Gizzard album, just wait for the next one. It'll come out in 6 months and it'll be totally different.
It will. Keith, it's been a pleasure. Thanks so much for your time.
Thanks, sir. Thanks for having me.